COVID-19 and Maine's healthcare system. Are we ready? Yesterday, Governor Mills announced that the Maine National Guard will soon set up beds and medical equipment at arenas in Portland and Bangor. These will serve as overflow sites if Maine's hospitals become overwhelmed with COVID-19 cases. So far, they are not. There are still ICU beds and ventilators available. But public health experts have been studying the experience of other states and are bracing for Maine to see a surge in serious cases soon. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with hospital leaders about the state of Maine's preparedness for more COVID-19 cases. From testing to ventilators to the number of frontline workers, where does Maine stand in the battle against this pandemic? And what about the care of other patients? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Hospitals in Maine are faced with simultaneously gearing up for a possible surge in COVID-19 cases while also caring for other patients and their own healthcare workers. Today, we're going to learn how they're faring in terms of equipment, testing, and staff, and what they're concerned about. Joining me, Dr. John Alexander, who is Chief Quality Officer for Central Maine Healthcare, and Dr. James Jarvis, Medical Specialist with Incident Command for Northern Light Health at Eastern Maine Medical Center. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. Are you wondering if hospitals have enough supplies and people to handle the growing pandemic? What questions do you have about patient care? Or are you a healthcare worker who would like to share your experience? Share your stories and questions at email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. But to both of you, Governor Mills just announced that there will be two alternative sites for healthcare in Portland and in Bangor soon, the big arenas in each city. Can you talk about what that will mean for your hospitals? Dr. Jarvis.
It is planned that for both the arena in Portland and the arena in Bangor that we will be setting up some kind of facilities there. I will say that on a conversation call that we had yesterday that included Dr. Alexander as well, that we feel that we would be utilizing these not for acute care, so meaning those people who are acutely ill who require hospitalization, but perhaps using it for individuals who are recovering from either COVID-19 or other healthcare conditions where they are not ready to return home or it's not safe for them to return home. So they still need some kind of oversight, more like what we would do in one of our acute rehab or skilled nursing facilities, and allowing those patients to be there and get that care that they need without filling up our hospitals who we feel will be needed for those who need acute care.
All right. Dr. Alexander, anything to add to that?
Well, no. So as Dr. Jarvis mentioned, we've been meeting now as part of the statewide group since last week and had the opportunity to discuss the use of these alternate care sites. I think one of the things that's important to highlight with what he described is that as a rural state, we already have areas where we don't have enough resources in terms of post-acute care facilities, skilled nursing facilities, long-term care facilities, acute rehab. And so we do feel this is the best approach for us to take in terms of finding a safe place for these patients to have care delivered to them in a less intense way than they might in one of our acute care facilities, and thereby allow the providers and the frontline caregivers to focus on those acutely ill patients in our hospitals throughout the state.
I actually
just left the Cross Insurance Center here in Bangor, where there was a meeting of Northern Light Health officials, officials from Penobscot Community Health Center, and officials from St. Joseph's Hospital, as well as members of the Bangor City government and the Army Corps of Engineers. And it was a very good meeting, and we think that we have a plan going forward in order to set this facility up with our hope that we never have to use it.
Dr. Jarvis, when do you think he'll be ready?
Hard to say. The governor's office had given us a request of trying to have these stood up within the next 7 days. There's some logistical complications to that, but Northern Light Health will be taking the lead on logistics and working with those very important partners here in the Bangor area. And similar preparations are being done by the health systems in the Portland area in order to try to accomplish what the governor's office has asked of us.
The governor and Dr. Shaw of Maine CDC have referred to the potential for a surge of cases here in Maine. I know we seem to be later than other states in testing and identifying people with the virus. Dr. Alexander, is it inevitable that we will follow similar patterns of a steeper rise as we've seen elsewhere in the country?
So I think with the way you asked the question, Jen, that it's not necessarily inevitable. It's certainly very likely, and we absolutely have to prepare accordingly. You know, again, one of the unique characteristics that we have in the state is that there's already a certain amount of distance between individuals. Even our large cities are not heavily populated like you see in other states around the country. Governor Mills and Maine CDC have been doing a great job of trying to stay ahead of implementing precautions, implementing social distancing, and implementing even to the point of travel restrictions. So we're hopeful that we're going to see less of an impact, certainly less of a steep rise in cases. But we absolutely have to be prepared. And, as Dr. Jarvis referenced, I think you're seeing right now that the major effects are in the more populated counties of York and Cumberland. So we're all working together between health systems to try to make sure that we're able to support each other with whatever might need to come.
I'll ask each of you this, and I'll start with you, Dr. Jarvis. Do you have any cases of COVID-19 in your hospitals right now? And if so, how many?
So across Northern Light Health, and again, we're a 10 hospital system. We have currently several patients that are have tested positive for COVID-19. The majority of those are in the Portland area. I don't have the exact numbers for you right this second, but our numbers are small, which we are very thankful for. Knowing, of course, that Maine Medical Center is the largest hospital in the state, has had far more cases than the rest of us. We are seeing that spread. We are seeing it in more of our communities than we had previously. And I'll echo what Dr. Alexander said, that we need to be diligent about this and remain resolute and continue to do our social distancing and good hand washing and good cough and sneeze etiquette. We should not be lulled into a sense of security simply by the low numbers. We're fortunate in Maine. This is the same kind of thing that we see with our influenza seasons. We usually are later than the rest of the country and so can evaluate what they are doing. And so I think we need to be prepared that we will see an increase in those numbers. But if we all do the things that the governor's office has asked us to do, hopefully we can keep that peak to be a lower number than was originally projected for us.
Dr. Alexander, what are you seeing at Central Maine Healthcare? How many cases?
So similar to what Northern Lights Health System is seeing, we're seeing approximately the same number. So we have several patients who are admitted and more or less have been on a day-to-day basis who are under investigation. We've seen single digits of number of cases with confirmed COVID. We've had only one or two patients who've had to go on to a ventilator associated with their COVID disease. So again, we've been fortunate in not having the significant strain of high volume of cases like has been seen further in the south at Maine Medical Center or at Southern Maine Medical Center. But our preparations continue to move forward.
Dr. Alexander, I'm glad you mentioned ventilators because I wanted to ask you a little bit about those. There's been a lot of reporting nationally about how there's a lack of ventilators, not enough ventilators here on Maine Calling. We've highlighted the starfish that Dan Abbott at Southern Maine Community College has come up with that might extend ventilator usage. Can we step back and have you explain what a ventilator does? Does it actually breathe for a person? And then also, if someone is sick enough to be on a ventilator, how many people who go on a ventilator will survive in the long run? What's the experience so far?
Sure. So first, a ventilator is a piece of equipment, and essentially what it does is it takes over the mechanical operation of moving oxygen in and removing carbon dioxide out of the lungs. It's it's done through an endotracheal tube, or sometimes through a tracheostomy, a tube that's projecting from the neck that oftentimes we see in people who've had to undergo serious surgeries. And so the mechanical ventilator helps to control how much oxygen is being delivered, whether that is at a room air level, or 21% of, 21% of our air is oxygen, or if it's at a higher level, 30%, 40%, or 50%. It also controls the pressure or force with which the oxygen is being delivered through to the patient, and it can also assist in helping to keep the lungs open further. One of the things that we see in patients who end up requiring ventilatory support or use of a ventilator is that their lung tissue gets inflamed. They tend to acquire some fluid in the lung tissue itself, and that makes it harder sometimes for the lung pockets in the lung to stay open, which also then in turn makes it harder for the patient's lung to exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide, which is the job. So that's more or less what a ventilator is able to perform. In terms of overall, we are seeing pretty significant high rates of mortality or low rates of survival when we see patients get on to a ventilator. It is variable, and so it's hard to give a hard and fast number to that, but it's a significant number. And one of the things that a lot of our critical care specialists are doing is looking at different strategies to help improve that survivability. One of those includes making sure that we get patients onto a ventilator early in the course of their disease, if necessary, to help hopefully ward off more advanced or severe lung damage. The other is, in fact, a technique where patients are, instead of being laying flat on their back, they're turned over because it's thought that that actually helps to ventilate or improve oxygen and carbon dioxide exchange in different parts of the lung. So lots of strategies that are the clinical teams are looking at to try to do the best that they can with patients once they get to that state.
And at this point, Dr. Alexander, do you have ventilators that are not in use that are ready if you do have patients who need them?
We do. We have ventilators that are not in use that are on standby. We're keeping track of those. And we're doing that in conjunction with systems such as Dr. Jarvis's at Northern Lights and Maine Health and others. In addition, we've also been looking at use of anesthesia machines and how do we convert an anesthesia machine. So the device that's used when a patient goes into an operating room and has to go under general anesthesia, that's a form of ventilator. And so how do we use those in the instance that we might need to if we run out of traditional ventilators?
And Dr. Jarvis, what about supplies in your system? And are there enough ventilators if a few more patients come in the next couple days?
So, yes, we do have capacity to do that currently at Northern Light, both at EMMC and then at some of our smaller facilities have the capacity to increase in our ventilatory support. And so we do have ventilators on hand for that. In addition, across our system, and we're trying to collaborate across the state, is that our smaller hospitals who have ventilators usually used in their emergency departments for rescue before the patient needs to be transferred to one of our larger medical centers is collaborating with them. They should not be taking care of such critically ill patients at this time. And so trying to coordinate that if a patient did need to be transferred from one of the smaller hospitals, that the ventilator actually goes with them from that hospital to a larger facility like EMMC or Maine Medical Center or Central Maine Medical Center, so that we can make sure that we can keep the supply available for those individuals who need it the most. I will say one of the remarkable things about living in Maine is that we do talk to one another on a regular basis. And it's been a pleasure to discuss with the other three big health systems what our overall strategies will be for the state of Maine. What we see around the country, unfortunately, is that kind of collaboration is not occurring. And so you do see competition between facilities for things like ventilator support or critical care beds or even staffing. And we're trying to avoid that happening here in our state.
Let's talk about protecting staff. There's been so much reporting out there about the lack of enough PPE, personal protective equipment. Dr. Jarvis, is your system at where it needs to be in terms of personal protective equipment for your healthcare workers now?
So currently, with the level of patient care that we are performing, we are well supplied right now. It's really that preparation for the unknown. What happens if we have a surge, and what happens if the numbers are larger than we had anticipated? So we have all taken steps in order to try to preserve that personal protective equipment. One of the strategies that we have done is to extend the use of the non-N95 or special masks. So these masks are normal procedural masks, medical grade quality, and extending the use of those beyond what we normally would under normal circumstances. And so that has helped us to keep our supplies adequate across Northern Light Health. Our current policy is that employees who we feel need to be within 6 feet of another individual, whether that be a patient, a staff member, or any other individual, we do provide them with procedural masks. We do feel at Northern Light that we are fortunate with our supply of those special N95 masks, which offer a level of protection not just against droplet precautions, which is what we believe COVID-19 offers, but also airborne precautions as well. And we feel we have an adequate supply of those as well due to the fact that we are limiting their use to certain circumstances. And then also because we believe that we will be able to reuse those masks after proper technique to sterilize them and make sure that they do not become a threat to our own staff of spreading disease. So between those two measures, I feel that we will be prepared in the event of a surge. But everything is going to be based on what happens in the moment. It is very concerning that our national supply chain for all personal protective equipment, but especially those very special N95 masks, is extremely limited right now, and is why our staff are anxious about a coming surge.
All right, and I want to ask the same question to you, Dr. Alexander.
Sure. So, one of the statements made by a public health official at Maine Health that we've had the pleasure, both Dr. Jarvis and I, of talking with and working with over the last month and a half or so, made the comment that when you implement public health standards or when you implement public health initiatives, beforehand, everything looks like it's very reactive. After the fact, it looks like you made the right choice. And so what we've been doing at Central Maine, we do have adequate amounts of personal protective equipment from face shields through to masks, gowns, and gloves. But we implemented and we continue to implement measures to try to control the use of those items. And so one example was the visitor restrictions that all of the health systems have now put into place. Part of that was to prevent people from coming into one of our acute care facilities and potentially, if they were asymptomatic, spreading coronavirus. It was certainly also to protect them as well. But the other part was to try to limit the number of people who would have to use a mask if necessary. We've done that not only with our visitors, we've done that with our own healthcare workers. We've made it very clear in terms of number where staff members can enter and where they can exit. And so we look at our volume of supplies on a twice a day basis and continue to try to figure out ways that we can continue to conserve. We also are looking at plans for how we can extend the use of our personal protective equipment and if necessary, reuse it.
We're talking with Dr. John Alexander from Central Maine Healthcare and Dr. James Jarvis at Northern Light Health about how Maine's hospitals, Maine's healthcare system is preparing for a potential surge in COVID-19 cases, serious cases. There's so much we still haven't talked about yet. We haven't talked about testing. We haven't talked about the financial impact on the hospitals or morale. But we do need to take a break. When we come back, we will talk about those topics and more. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from F.L. Putnam, committed to providing responsible fiduciary investment and wealth management for Maine families and institutions. FLPutnam.com. And New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org.
As the coronavirus pandemic has made staying home the safe bet, the online meeting platform Zoom has experienced massive growth, but found that its selling point, ease of use, was also its Achilles heel. Now, says CEO Eric Yuen,
we want to do all we can to focus on privacy and security, and even at the cost of multiple clicks.
Rethinking Zoom this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. The daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus takes place at about 11:15 each morning. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, each day's address is archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is scheduled for 11:15 each morning and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, how are Maine hospitals and healthcare workers handling the COVID-19 pandemic and whatever comes next? My guests are Dr. Jim Jarvis. He is with Incident Command for Northern Light Health at Eastern Maine Medical Center. And Dr. John Alexander, Chief Quality Officer for Central Maine Healthcare. And joining us on the line now is Jessica Ballard. She is with Maine's Department of Health and Human Services in the Office of Behavioral Health. Thanks for calling in, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what your office is doing to support healthcare workers during this crisis.
Well, we know that the COVID-19 pandemic is extraordinarily stressful for everyone, but particularly on first responders and healthcare workers. They, more so than most, are really having to put their own health and safety at risk in order to support others and to respond to the pandemic. So we're setting up a warm line, which is essentially a call-in service for healthcare workers and first responders to connect with their peers to get support from other first responders and healthcare professionals. So we really want to make sure that the first responders and healthcare workers know that their peers are here for them, and we've got a network of over 100 volunteers who are healthcare professionals and first responders themselves who are going to be offering support with a particular evidence-based approach.
And that's starting next week?
Yeah, we're hoping to go live with that as soon as next week. We just have to get the line set up. We've got a few other pieces to put into place. But this has really been a joint effort from a number of different organizations, and it's really been nice to see so many different organizations and individuals coming together to support these populations who we know from other disasters and public health emergencies really can bear the brunt of what that stress can be like.
Well, Jessica, thank you so much for calling in. That was Jessica Pollard with the Department of Health and Human Services, Behavioral Health Department. Thank you so much for calling into Maine Calling today. Dr. Alexandra, there are several things I wanted to talk about, but let's talk about healthcare workers. How is morale? I know that your hospital had to your healthcare system had to announce furloughs this morning. I can imagine the tension of dealing with this pandemic and the same time the hospital's taking a financial hit cannot be easy.
It's not. And, I've seen a lot of my colleagues around the hospital and around the system just really, I would say just morose on some level to have to come to these types of decisions. You know, that being said, we've been pretty transparent with our employees through this entire process. We've been letting them know first about what our supplies are, what our plans are, where we are financially, some of the actions that we were taking early on. We've had the opportunity to have, conversations really face-to-face or one-to-one conversations with all of our employees who have been affected, which includes not only those who have either accepted or have been furloughed, Also, those individuals who have reduced their hours, our directors and some of our executive team who have taken either pay cuts or pay deferrals, and some of our providers who have also taken deferrals or reductions in their pay. So it's been a difficult time, but I think we've been trying to give people the information that they need to at least understand what's happening. You know, we all know that this is a lot of uncertainty. You know, we've talked for a few weeks now, and every week there's new challenges and there's new information that's coming out, and that creates a lot of uncertainty in itself. That being said, you know, I've continued to check in with different staff members in different parts of our hospitals, and they're really committed to taking care of patients. You know, it's I want to contrast the concern and the obvious sense of anxiety with the fact that our caregivers are really taking care of each other. You can see them laughing with each other. You can see them joking with patients. And so we're trying to maintain that normal sense of human compassion and keep things as normal as we can amidst a lot of uncertainty.
And just to be clear, because it might seem counterintuitive that a hospital has to furlough people right now, the reason being is that there's no income from things like elective surgeries or other procedures right now, because other whole sections of the hospital are basically closed right now, right?
That's correct. You know, a little bit ago, we were talking about some of the early actions taken, and one of the key early actions taken was to postpone either procedures or visits that could be postponed safely, that did not impact the overall health of the individual. And so we've seen a pretty significant reduction across the board in hospitalizations, procedures, surgeries, primary care visits, emergency department visits. Some of that, I think, is also due to the fact that a lot of our community members have taken the stay at home very, very seriously. And so, you know, for example, at Central Maine Medical Center in downtown Lewiston, where we will typically see somewhere between 120 and upwards of 150 patients a day, we're seeing visits that are closer to 60 or 70, sometimes 80 a day. It's interesting because what we're also seeing is that the very sick patients are still coming in. So there's some sense of relief in knowing that people who need to access emergency services or their primary care or other specialists are doing so. They're also making choices around what can be postponed versus what needs to be addressed right away.
Mm. What's the situation for Northern Light, Dr. Jarvis? Is there also a big financial hit, and could you see something like furloughs or pay cuts?
So lucky and fortunately right now is we are not considering furloughs. We continue to try to cross-train employees who may not be, who may be in a practice that's not seeing patients right now, and trying to get them to fill in some of the gaps for us. Certainly the financial aspects of this are taken into consideration, and we would much rather not be talking about those kind of things during a crisis or at any time, but that's the reality, that the revenue-generating portion of healthcare has been mostly put on hold right now, and appropriately so. And we will be reassessing and evaluating that as we need to. I think what Dr. Alexander explained going on at Central Maine Health is similar to what we're seeing at Northern Light Health. I will say that we have stepped up our ability to do what's called telehealth, which is able to the patient can remain at home and talk to one of our caregivers. It is not as lucrative as a face-to-face visit is for us, but it still allows us to provide care for those individuals who continue to need care. Individuals with chronic diseases still need to have those managed even while we're facing this pandemic, and maybe even more so. And so we're able to provide that. We're also able to provide some acute care. I will share that my own daughter today did one of these virtual visits. And it went well, and she was prescribed a new medication. And I think that's great that we're able to do that. In fact, I'm hopeful that when we're at the other end of this crisis, that we'll continue to do some things that I think are actually beneficial for our patients and our community. How great would it be if we could do a lot of our visits virtually rather than having to drive to a doctor's office when we're not acutely ill and we really just need to talk to somebody? So I'm hopeful that this will actually help improve our healthcare system going forward.
Sure. We have an email question that's related to that. This is from Ed. He writes, my wife had a telemedicine appointment yesterday that required a video connection. I had to spend quite some time trying different ways to make the video conference work and eventually only did it because I had a work webcam available. I also happened to have a blood pressure cuff and thermometer to help with getting those measures. As we look at more telehealth as an alternative during this crisis and in the future, how will this be feasible with many people not having the technology or the skills and tools to do that? And so I'll turn that question back to you, Dr. Jarvis.
Yeah, and that's a great concern. That's actually one of the issues that we've dealt with Northern Light Health, is that we have individuals who just don't have internet capabilities or the bandwidth to support such kind of visits. And so we are utilizing telephone as well as Zoom capabilities or other telehealth capabilities. It is a struggle for those who do not have that kind of equipment at home. When we do have it available, it makes for these things to go very, very well. I do think, again, I'm hopeful that this will shed a light on some of those areas where frankly, many of our members of our population have been underserved. And so increasing bandwidth across our state for internet capabilities, increasing access. I know that the city of Bangor and its school district right now is looking towards volunteers to help provide broadband internet access for its students so that they can actually do virtual learning as well. Thankfully, it sounds like they were able to procure computers, but that computer isn't helpful if you can't connect to the school. And so those are concerns and things that we need to strive to work and to improve. I will say that many of us still have cell phones, and the cameras on the cell phones are also very, very good for utilizing this kind of technology. So sometimes we have to think a little bit outside the box and use another tool to help us with that.
We have an email here from Peyton. It seems to me that the precautions we are taking here in Maine are extraordinary. It's hard to see how the cases here would overflood the hospitals. How could that happen, Dr. Alexander?
Well, I would say that we are taking, under normal circumstances, very extraordinary measures in the state of Maine. Even if you start simply at the stay-at-home the voluntary request to have masking outside. But in terms of how could it be possible to be overwhelmed, what we don't know about the virus, again, we're getting more information really on a day-to-day basis, but what we don't know about the virus but suspect is that there is some percentage of spread that occurs from asymptomatic individuals. It is not strictly from individuals who have clear symptoms or are clearly certainly positive in testing. And so those types of conditions, that condition requires that we continue to have vigilance around good respiratory hygiene. That's one of the reasons we've implemented masking really in all of our facilities around the state, staying at home if you're ill, monitoring for fever. As spring advances and summer approaches and, the number of cases may or may not necessarily blossom, there's a concern that there may be some reservoir of virus that's out there and that those individuals could potentially create, I think, what has been called on the national news a second wave. And so that's why we are trying to be as diligent as possible about our planning and our preparations right now, partly for what could be a surge coming over the next several weeks, and certainly what could become an issue either on a seasonal or annual basis. Or, I think we've all come to the realization now that this is something that we need to be prepared for even in the future. So what we're doing right now not only helps to protect our communities and help protect our care workers right now, but also in the future.
Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You might have time for a quick email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We are taking your questions about hospitals, healthcare, and about COVID-19 and how the virus spreads. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Savvy Event Rental. With Tidewater sailcloth tents, handcrafted farm tables, walnut crossback chairs, and more. SavvyEventRental.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Looking ahead, a total solar eclipse will take place on Monday, April 8, 2024, visible across North America. It will be the only total solar eclipse in the 21st century where totality is visible in Mexico, the United States, and Canada. The line of totality will go almost directly over Maine's highest point, Mount Katahdin. The last U.S. total solar eclipse was a relatively short 7 years ago, and the previous one was 38 years prior to that.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine!
In these uncertain times, can you feel good if you know you don't look good? The salons are shut, the sign on the barber's door says closed, and doing it yourself is really only for the brave. It's not a top pandemic priority, but without a professional to turn to, how do you care for your hair? Hair do's and don'ts, next time on 1A.
And 1A is coming up this afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are talking with hospital leaders today about how their healthcare systems are dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. Joining me, Dr. John Alexander with Central Maine Healthcare and Dr. Jim Jarvis with Northern Light Health. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. If you hurry, you can get a brief email into talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Rebecca on Facebook posted, is there a point to using precious testing supplies on patients when they are already in the ICU? This particular patient was tested after being admitted to the hospital with severe respiratory distress, but was not tested prior to this despite age and on IV antibiotics, despite direct extended contact with someone who's been tested positive. Why wasn't this person more supported? Thoughts on that? I'm sure you all don't know specifics about this patient, but why would somebody be tested after they're already in the hospital in respiratory distress?
I'll take that question. So I'll start with why not testing before that. So we have an extremely limited amount of testing supplies, both here within in the state of Maine and across the country. So much so that we really are restricting the testing to very specific categories, which we call Tier 1. Those individuals are those sick enough to require hospitalization, our healthcare workers and first responders, because we need to get them back to work and on the front lines to take care of other individuals, and those individuals living in what we call congregate living situations or close quarters, such as nursing homes, other long-term care facilities, our shelters, and other facilities like that. It's purely by math. It is simply because we don't have enough testing supplies. If we have an individual who is sick enough that needs to be in the hospital, there are several reasons why testing is appropriate. The first is if they test negative, then we don't have to use the certain level of personal protective equipment, and then we can keep that in reserve to be used for other individuals. So that is definitely part of our testing philosophy, is what can we do to help limit the use of personal protective equipment, which is also in short supply. And then there are some treatment concerns that we have to look at. While nothing right now is proven to address and to cure COVID-19, there are some things out there that can be tried, particularly for those individuals who are in a critical care setting and not getting better. And so knowing for sure that they're COVID positive before we try some of these unproven or untested treatments is definitely important because these treatments can be harmful in the wrong setting. And so we don't want to be using them in individuals who we suspect have COVID and not individuals who we know have COVID. So that's really the clear distinction for us. I will tell you that every healthcare worker wishes that we had more tests and that we could be testing other symptomatic individuals as well. It would help us as we prepare for the surge to know exactly what's going on in our communities. It would help us to prepare for our supplies for that same kind of thing. And unfortunately, we just don't have the ability to do that.
We'll go to Lawton, who's calling from Penobscot. Hi, Lawton. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, first off, thanks to all the healthcare workers for doing what they do. I was wondering what happened to Abbott Laboratories' quick test that was supposed to be able to tell in 15 or 20 minutes if it was a positive. Supposedly a million of those tests went out, and I haven't heard any more.
So I can answer that question, too, because I actually just got an email about that. So I think that was an overpromise and an underdeliverer on the part of certain individuals reporting those numbers out. The number of actual devices that Abbott can make is limited, and the number of actual testing. There's a device that runs the test, but you have a cartridge that you put the sample in to put into the device. And unfortunately, the number of those cartridges that they actually use to put into the machine is extremely limited. Unfortunately, I do not see that being an answer for us to increase our testing in any meaningful way in the short run. Hopefully in the long run that will resolve itself and we'll be able to see that. But I am actually now telling my providers, do not look for that as the next phase for us or in any way saving us to give us more resources. We are not counting on that now. Hopefully they'll be able to increase manufacturing, but it's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. And it's also been reported that Martin's Point Healthcare has said that it will receive the first supply of these tests, but has not received them yet. I'm sorry, Dr. Alexander, did you want to jump in?
No, I just wanted to add a couple of points to that. The first is that, you know, there's been a lot of discussion again at both at our level in the state and then on the national level about how do we share resources and how do we allocate resources to where they're most needed? And so, you know, regardless of what the number of those testing kits available are, whether it's 100,000 or a million or whatever the number is, you know, I think we have to recognize that when you look at a situation that has been occurring in a place like New York or California or Michigan or New Orleans, that those are clearly places where there's a high population density. There's a lot of people who are both sick and the potential to have spread because of their close living quarters and the density. It makes more rational sense. The only other point I wanted to make was just about in terms of then the testing and because we're talking about limiting how we limit our testing. And then, you know, as Dr. Jarvis described in the example of the ICU patient, the other reason to perform testing on a patient who is suspected is if we haven't put those precautions into place and we are not deliberately putting every patient who comes into the into a hospital on precautions, because we would again run out of the personal protective equipment, it is important to then understand if there's a suspicion who's been exposed, if they were exposed in fact to someone with COVID, and then what are their exposures. So we also don't want to contribute to any spread, and that's one of the reasons why sometimes we're performing some testing after the fact, again along the lines of does it involve a first responder or a healthcare worker or someone who would be at a high risk?
Lawton, thanks so much for your call. We have an email from Michael. He writes, I appreciate how hard it is for hospitals to rise to meet the overwhelming demands of a pandemic at the same time as making substantial cuts in staff. Seems like there should be part of the recent $2 trillion appropriation committed to this. Seems like it is going into battle on behalf of all of us, with one arm tied behind the back. And I want to mention that there's a brand new press release from the Congresswoman Pingree's office that says that about $4,116,000 from that relief package will go to Maine hospitals. Does $4 million to you sound like very much, Dr. Alexander?
Well, $4 million to all of the hospitals in the state, unfortunately, makes it a relatively small amount per each hospital, especially when you likely consider that you're going to provide more of those fundings to larger hospitals that have larger workforces than to smaller hospitals. You know, one of the other points that Dr. Jarvis made earlier was about, he was referring to telehealth. One of the things that has made telehealth possible is because we have relaxed some of the strict regulatory requirements around reimbursement for those services. And that's one of the areas that, as he mentioned, I think there's an opportunity for us to be looking at right now and to continue to look at as we move forward to say, as we implemented our actions to address this pandemic, what coming out of this should we keep in place because it serves a greater need? And that's one of the areas where, you know, it is certainly a good example of that. Other opportunities for funding and other opportunities to be able to utilize resources differently is another one.
Yeah. So in the future, perhaps doctors will be able to be reimbursed for a phone call in a way that they were not in the past.
Correct.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. An email from Kenneth. I wonder if one of the doctors could give an estimate of how long a COVID-19 patient is likely to need mechanical ventilation support. It sounds like it can be a rather long time compared to other pulmonary diseases, up to 16 or 20 days. Does it depend on other comorbidities, et cetera? Is successful outcome more exception than the rule? And then a PS, applause and massive thanks to all of our frontline medical personnel. We talked about ventilators a little bit before. Is that right, 16 to 20 days?
So we have been seeing that the length of time for the entire course of this virus, for those who do get symptomatic and become critically ill, has been much longer than we see with, say, influenza virus or other respiratory type viruses. And that is concerning. It's the reason why you see in New York and other large metropolitan areas that they are struggling, because what normally would be a shorter course of somebody needing either critical care or mechanical ventilation is a longer course. I have a good friend of mine who unfortunately is quite ill from this disease, and very similar to what you see described for Boris Yeltsin, when 1 to 2 weeks of just some mild symptoms, but then all of a sudden progressively got worse and unfortunately yesterday needed to be put on mechanical ventilation. I will say that probably having comorbid diseases is probably a factor in that. But some of it is just still so unknown for us. So that makes it, again, that big concerning issue for us is just not having enough data to be able to speculate or to treat people appropriately, and that's a big concern. I will respond to the PS, though. I will tell you that our healthcare workers, hearing from the population and your listeners that they're supported, that you recognize the sacrifices that they're making, is so important to their morale. Oftentimes, we consider healthcare a thankless profession, and hearing these kind of warm and welcoming remarks from your listeners and everybody else has just been fantastic. I just saw some people have signs out in front of their house that just says, it said, thank you for our healthcare workers, thank you for our teachers. And I agree with that. It's just wonderful. And so I applaud your listeners for doing so.
And I'm sorry to hear about your friend. I want to make a quick correction to something I said before. Congresswoman Pingree announced $4,116,000 to hospitals in Maine's first congressional district. So that's not to either of your main hospitals, which, you know, I don't have the press release from Jared Golden's office in front of me. So I imagine it's probably somewhere in the same ballpark. I'm going to go to Valencia, who's calling from Stonington. Hi, Valencia. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a patient within the Northern Lights system, and I have been using Zoom for medical appointments. My family has used it. But Zoom is not a secure system, and it's being investigated by both the FBI and the New York Attorney General's office. So what are the hospital systems doing to make sure their patients' information is secure?
Dr. Jarvis, I'll throw this to you.
Thank you. That is a wonderful question. I will tell you that the Zoom that we are using is not the Zoom that is the Zoom of concern. We use one that is HIPAA compliant, meaning that it is compliant with all of the rules and regulations for patient privacy. It is a direct contact number, and so therefore we are not having what you see has been happening, like for school districts and other businesses, where people are, quote, Zoom bombing and getting in on the call. Our secure system, you would have to give somebody else the link that we provide for you for the visit, rather than them being able to find it by doing a search. And so we feel that our system is secure in that regard, and that it is protected information. We value your privacy, and we'll do everything we can to ensure that we continue to keep your privacy.
Valencia, thank you so much for your call. We have just a few minutes left, and I want to give each of you a chance to talk about what you want the general public to know or understand as we move forward and likely into a surge situation. Dr. Alexander. Dr. Alexander, are you still there?
Oh, I'm still here. Sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to start by responding to the appreciation and the thanks that a number of your emailers and callers have shared. You know, that's one of the things that I think has been so uplifting to see around the state and so fulfilling for the healthcare workers to see. We continue to see people who are volunteering to sew masks, to deliver food, to frankly, to we've seen neighbors take care of, you know, their neighbors' children who may be a nurse or someone who's working in a hospital and need to go in and take care of people. So we really appreciate all that has been done to support the healthcare workers. They are truly heroes, and they're exhibiting a lot of bravery to come in and take care of patients because they know that they're needed and they have special skills and a purpose to do so. You know, the other thing I think I would share with the general public is that, you know, we are still in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. There are a lot of projections that are out there, and even those of us who are working in our incident command centers recognize that different projections and different models have a lot of different variables to them. And so we are preparing to be able to manage patients, whether they are critically ill or they are mildly ill or need some convalescence afterwards. Whenever that happens. And so we appreciate the support of the public. We appreciate your confidence in us. And we also appreciate everything that you know, every Mainer is doing to stay home, to stay safe.
Thank you. And that's going to have to be our last word. That was Dr. John Alexander, Chief Quality Officer for Central Maine Healthcare. Also with us, Dr. James Jarvis, Medical Specialist with Incident Command for Northern Light Health at Eastern Maine Medical Center. Thank you both so much for coming back to Maine Calling. Tomorrow on the program, Maine's Commissioners of Labor and Economic Development join us to answer questions about help for businesses and individuals. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.